Welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, your headquarters for building a six-figure plus e-commerce business. I'm your host, e-commerce entrepreneur, and Jeff Bezos wannabe, Andrew Derry. Hey guys, Andrew here, and welcome to episode number 8 of the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast. Today in the main segment, I've got Bill D'Alessandro. Bill's an ex-investment banker who took his experience buying and selling large multi-million dollar companies in corporate America and applied that to niche e-commerce stores. And in the discussion, we talk about how to value stores, where to find them, what to look for, and we kind of dive into the classic buy versus build argument. He's got a ton of experience with this stuff, and it's a really interesting discussion, so stick around for that. But first, as always, first sale shout out. Excited to be doing this for Carol Rains from RusticArtistry.com. And Carol writes in, she says, "Just a quick note to say thank you, because I got my first sale in my e-commerce store today, and you played a big part in helping me get to this point. The blog posts, ebook, and video tutorials really hit their mark. I truly appreciate your generous mentoring." And she also attributes some of that success in mentoring as well to Steve Chow, who I think she's been following for quite a while. Steve, of course, over at mywifequitherjob.com and was on the podcast a few episodes ago. So Carol, congratulations. Glad we've been able to help out so much, and thrilled for your first sale. It's a big deal. So congratulations. And one last thing before diving into the interview and discussion. I listened to a great interview this week with Shopify CEO on startups, or this week in startups rather. And they covered a lot of great stuff. You know, what's going to happen with e-commerce in the future, how Amazon plays into the e-commerce environment right now, the death of shopping malls, how to differentiate well, you know, all sorts, a lot of great stuff. So I'm going to link up to that in the show notes. You can find it that way. You can also find it just by typing in "this week in startups Shopify," and you should be able to pull up the interview. Highly recommend it. It's well worth the listen. So with that being said, let's go ahead and dive into today's discussion with Bill. I've got Bill D'Alessandro with me today from RebelCEO.com. Bill, looking forward to chatting e-commerce, old investment banking stories, and M&A. So thanks for taking the time to chat.
Yeah, this is going to be fun.
It is going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it. So, you know, we're kind of a couple of rare guys, both ex-investment bankers who got out of the industry and are now in niche e-commerce sites. I'm guessing not a ton of us around. So can you kind of talk about your days in investment banking, how you got into that, and how you kind of moved from investment banking out of that industry and into e-commerce?
Yeah, sure. So a little bit of background on me. In college, I majored in finance and entrepreneurship. I had a company in college, which was fun. It was a software company, but I sold it when I graduated and took a job in investment banking, which turned out to be the worst thing I could have ever done because I hated it. And I will say, I shouldn't knock on banking too much. I learned a ton. You know, I worked my balls off, worked 100 hours a week plus, and learned a whole lot of stuff that I'm sure we will get into today that has served me very well. But it was also pretty miserable at the time. I've always been an entrepreneur. I mean, I ended up in investment banking, and I was getting, and I basically learned what I had set out to learn from the folks at the bank, and I was looking to get back into working for myself. One night, I come home from the office at like 1 in the morning, and I was just killing some time on the computer before bed, and I don't know if you've ever seen people, Andrew, with red bumps on their arms and thighs.
I have.
So it's called keratosis pilaris. It affects 40% of adults, 80% of teens. I'm sorry, 50% of adults and 80% of teens. And I have it. It's purely cosmetic, but it was bothering me. So I was Googling around, how do I get rid of this? What is this? Et cetera. And then I realized that I've been Googling for 30 minutes and no one had tried to sell me anything. And that's when I kind of went, whoa, you know, I need to make a product for KP. The trouble was I didn't know anything about skincare at all. So I learned. I went on a bunch of forums. I found things that people were using, that people were using certain acne creams or foot creams or avocado oil from the grocery store, and getting results. So I bought all these products and I said, what are the commonalities here that people are getting results for? Kind of cross-referenced these ingredient lists and spoke with a chemist. Eventually came up with a formula that I thought should work. Had a lab, found a lab in LA, and we can get into more about outsourced manufacturing if you want. But found a lab in LA to make it for me. Had the label and the website designed on Elance. And just kind of went for it.
So you've got the KP elements going, and then how long did you run that until you kind of walked into you know, your managing director's office at the bank and told them, hey man, I love it, but I've got this company, I'm quitting.
So I was working, I moonlighted on KP Elements for about a year.
Okay.
And finally was able to quit. The basic reason that I quit is because A, I had, you know, just, I was making just enough to pay my bills. You know, I wasn't going to be living the life of luxury, but I wasn't going to starve. And I also had this idea, so this is maybe a nice segue, I had this idea to go out and buy other e-commerce stores because I built this business, and it was because I was working while I was building the business, I didn't have time to run it. So I was essentially forced from the very beginning to automate everything. So I told you I initially had 1,000 units in my apartment. That went terribly for about 2 weeks before I needed to realize I needed a fulfillment company. So I got a fulfillment company shortly, very, very, very quickly. And actually I ended up firing them and moving to another fulfillment company called Shipwire, who I'm still with and who is fantastic. And if anybody's listening and wants an intro to Shipwire, they've been great for me and I can do it for you. But so I had Shipwire, outsourced all my fulfillment. I was doing all my own customer service because it was only email. I said, no phone number, I'm not answering the phone, I can't answer the phone during the day. So I was doing just email support. I had all of my kind of emails outsourced, had autoresponders set up with MailChimp, and I had programmed it such that I would check, I had a little script that would check my inventory at my fulfillment house every night, and if it got low based on my velocity, it would automatically email my manufacturer and say, hey, I need some more. So the business was totally automated. I was just had to dump more sales into the top of the funnel.
Stories like yours really impressed me, Bill, because when I built up my first business, I was completely, quit cold turkey and was working on it full time, and it was still just, you know, it's always a lot of work, but it was still a ton of work and mind games, and you know, it's a rough first 6 months or a year as you're scaling up. And you know, I hear stories about guys like you who get something off the ground like this, not only working a job, but working like an insane job like banking where you're in 80, 90, 100 hours a week. And it's just, it's impressive. It's really impressive.
Well, it took me longer, obviously, because I wasn't dedicating full-time effort to it. But in retrospect, it made me automate from the very beginning, which is a philosophy I have continued with.
Yeah.
So the reason I mentioned that is because, so I had this very automated infrastructure to run my first business, but I essentially had more automation than I had revenue. The automation that I built could handle a much bigger business than I had. So given my financial background, and you know, I know that you have as well, it kind of occurred to me that I should go out and acquire some companies, that I could go buy a small company and bolt it onto my automation infrastructure and outsource everything, probably take some cost out of the companies that I bought and scale up that way.
Yeah, that is a perfect segue, actually. And so you had, I mean, and you've got a really rare combination too of being able to, you've got a financial background, you've got the business background, and you've also got the tech background. And that's pretty rare to be able to have all of those three things. And so you've got this amazing infrastructure that automates a lot of things. And so you want to just bolt something on. Actually, it's perfect because I'd love to get more into deals. And really, one of the reasons I was excited to have you on was to talk about e-commerce deals and making those happen and kind of the nuts and bolts of how that all works. And so before we dive in and start talking all sorts of, you know, crazy banker lingo and stuff that that we kind of assume people know, I'd love to kind of maybe just hit a couple high points to give a good foundation for it. And so, you know, people will talk about a multiple. You know, I paid X multiple, or I got this company for a 3 multiple. So what does that mean exactly?
So you know, everybody will look at this differently. The way I prefer to look at it, I think you do too, Andrew, is and this is kind of the number that brokers, if you go to a broker who's selling a site, this is the methodology they'll use as well. They'll refer to a site as being priced as a multiple of seller's discretionary income, or sometimes you'll hear EBITDA. EBITDA stands for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. Not without getting too accounting on you, basically an approximation of how much cash flow the business makes. The business brokers use a term called SDE, seller's discretionary income, which is the metric for after I have paid all the obligations of the business, basically how much does the owner pay himself at the end of the year? How much is left over? So when you go to buy a business, you will typically pay multiple of SDE. And that multiple, you know, could be anywhere. I mean, when I was in banking, we sold businesses for 12 times EBITDA, but that is quite way too high. I mean, those businesses are, you know, 50, 100 million in revenue, much bigger than the businesses we're talking about here. The typical e-commerce businesses, and just by way of background, I looked for a year before I bought the first site that I bought in February. I looked at over 200 different companies. I just looked in my NDAs folder and I have signed over 200 NDAs.
And what is an NDA?
A non-disclosure agreement. So before a seller will give you any information about the business they're selling, they want to know that you're not just going to turn around and post it on the internet or give it to their competitors or whatnot. So they make you sign a legal document that basically says, I will keep a secret whatever you tell me about your business. So every time you look at a business, they'll make you sign one of those, typically one or two page document. So I signed over 200 of them just by one, which I bought in February of this year.
Yeah. And so what kind of huge differences? Because obviously they're completely different markets. So multiples is one when you're looking at some of these big business sales versus small ones. Are there any other notable differences that were pretty apparent when you moved from kind of corporate M&A into niche e-commerce M&A? When I say M&A, I mean mergers and acquisitions. So that's just kind of a term that refers to buying and selling companies.
Two things. One, both of which actually were somewhat more frustrating than when I had been used to be doing the bigger deals. The one is that frequently if you're buying an e-commerce site, the seller will try to get you to purchase the inventory separately. Andrew, I know I've talked to you about this as being one of my pet peeves before, but when you do a larger deal and I think when you do any deal, if you're selling widgets and you need to keep 100 widgets on hand at all times in order just to fulfill your orders that come in, and 100 widgets is your normalized level of inventory. I've seen a lot of sellers of niche e-commerce sites try to make you buy the business, but then also make you buy the 100 widgets from them at their cost. And that is very non-standard in larger deals, you know, more traditional M&A deals, because you can't buy the business without the widgets. If I just bought the business from you and said, I'll pass on buying those 100 widgets from you, the business would stop. The other thing that I've noticed too is that with larger M&A, you typically will hire an investment bank. So if you have a large company that you want to sell, you hire an investment banker, much like you would hire a real estate agent to sell your house. So for those people who aren't well-versed in investment banking, when someone says they're an investment banker, frequently they mean they're a real estate agent for companies. They represent a seller.
That's a good way to put it.
That's the way I like to describe it, so people understand. And investment bankers, you know, they are sometimes as depicted on TV. Perhaps Andrew and I are maybe a little bit different, but, you know, typically they're very professional. They follow up.
Very different.
They follow up very promptly, and they don't get paid unless they sell the business. So typically they're very motivated. You know, if a buyer calls them, they're very, very motivated. The thing that has frustrated me somewhat in smaller deals is that investment bankers won't typically handle deals below, you know, several million dollars. So you get into the realm of business brokers, which I would call sort of the JV investment bankers. And they're just not nearly so proactive because, you know, I expect if I would call a broker and say, hey, you know, these are the types of deals I'm looking for. You know, this is the size I'm looking for. This is the industry. When he gets one, I would expect him to call me. But frequently, they just go, oh, well, check my website. I list them, you know, occasionally, which is frustrating on one hand. But on the other hand, it can be a real opportunity for you as a buyer to differentiate if you hustle and continue to follow up with the broker and maybe get his listing before he puts it on his website so you can get the first bid, et cetera.
So what do you think? I mean, this is, and maybe this isn't something you can comment on, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Obviously, you've got a great, great background in this kind of stuff professionally, and you've done it a long time. And so if you were going to sell one of your businesses, chances are you definitely wouldn't hire a business broker. But for somebody else, you know, maybe somebody who's got an e-commerce business, and they're not as familiar with the market, with the space, with how you sell it, how you groom a company for sale, would you recommend hiring a business broker? Do you think that most your average business broker is going to bring, you know, a 10% of additional value and it's going to be able to get you a 10% or higher price to offset the fee that they charge?
I would say it vastly depends on who your broker is. I think there are probably a lot of brokers out there that take on any engagement that they can and they just help crank out a little 10 or 20 page book and then they forget about you. They list you on their website and forget about you. That guy, I would not pay 10%. If you're able to get a broker that is actively represents you, you know, helps you write your memorandum, but then also would call someone like me or Andrew and say, hey, I've got this business that's for sale. I think it might be a fit with what you already own. Then that guy, and then he would help you also negotiate price. I would say, yeah, it's probably is worth hiring a broker.
So in terms of deals, what do you look for in a good e-commerce deal? Because obviously you've shopped a ton of them. You know, you said you signed over 200 NDAs and looked at, kind of got under the hood on 200 different deals. So what are you looking for?
I would look for something that you're familiar with. I have ended up in the skincare industry by, you know, odd turns of fate, and I've learned a lot about it. And now I can speak pretty knowledgeably about skincare and shampoo and whatnot, which is just bizarre to me. but it would have been a lot easier if I had ended up in a business that I understood. You know, Andrew, I know that you're a big outdoorsman and a fisherman and whatnot. So you know, selling trolling motors probably makes a little bit more sense for you, or at least you can identify with the customer. I've had to do a lot of work to identify with my customer. So I would look for, you know, I look for now businesses in industries that I know. And now I include skincare and personal care on that list. Also look for very high customer loyalty. Because one thing that the software guys have on us, the product guys, is that they have this great recurring revenue stream. You know, someone subscribes and they just pay you every month, which is fantastic. That is not necessarily built into all physical products. Personal care is nice that way, because if you convince someone that this is the shampoo that you like, for example, right, you will tend to buy it again when you run out. So while you don't have this, you know, kind of 100% recurring revenue base, if you have a fan base that is very loyal, can begin to approximate this recurring revenue base in some physical products. I also look for a very strong brand. I mean, now in the world of, you know, Amazon.com sells everything, I think it's tough if you don't have any differentiator. You don't want to try to compete with Amazon on price, because they will slaughter you. They will bid you all the way to the bottom, and they will lose money just to drive you out of business. Yeah. I mean, they have $60 billion in revenue, and I think like almost a 0% profit margin. So for whatever reason, they're just not interested in making money right now. So you can't compete with that. So the way to compete is, A, I look for companies that make a proprietary product, because we didn't really make this clear at the beginning. I do not drop ship. All of the products that I make, the original business that I started and businesses I have acquired since, all we make the product, or we have an outsourced manufacturer make it, meaning no one else can make that product. If someone comes looking for our brand, they have to buy it from us. Or even if they buy it on Amazon, we've sold it to Amazon. Or if they buy it in a retail store, we've sold it to the retail store. So no one can knock off your brand. It kind of goes hand in hand with customer loyalty. So I look for a business with a strong brand, a proprietary brand, a proprietary product, and a loyal customer base.
In terms of looking for deals, where do you find them? Do you go to business? I mean, there's Flippa, obviously. There's business broker sites. How do you come uncover good deals?
Well, so I actually have not waded in the Flippa waters very deeply, mostly because Flippa is pretty – it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for, you know, what I call an e-tail site, you know, where you drop ship or retail other people's products, if you're looking for kind of like an affiliate site or a content site, I know there are a lot of those on Flippa. I have not had a lot of luck finding the things that I'm looking for, which is branded product companies. And, you know, I say that I'm in e-commerce, but what I actually am in is branded product companies that have e-commerce as a channel, as a primary channel. And I have not found a ton of those on Flippa. Where I have the most luck is kind of twofold. One on bizbuysell.com, which is where a lot of the business brokers will list their companies for sale. And also a couple of the broker sites directly I've gone to, and also just building relationships with brokers, like I mentioned to you earlier, and I just call them monthly and go, hey, what do you got? So it's a lot of hustle. If you want to find the best deal, it's not going to be easy to find, because if it's easy to find, everybody's going to find it and they're going to bid the price up. So you got to do what they would call in finance proprietary sourcing, which basically means finding your own deals.
So do you think you said Biz Buy Sell, is that the name of the primary site you go to?
Yeah, bizbuysell.com. For lack of a better word, it's kind of like Flippa. It's like an eBay for companies for sale.
Do you feel like there's room in the market for someone to come in and create a marketplace exclusively for vetted, screened e-commerce? Let's stick with e-commerce, for vetted, screened e-commerce companies for sale, given the fact that you know, there's just not a good place that has, you know, kind of solid quality listings?
Yeah, possibly. And I mean, in theory, like in the larger deal market, that is the service that an investment bank would provide. You know, they would be, you know, trying to get the best deals. They would scrub them up. They would vet them, and then they would proactively reach out to their buyers. But in this market, you know, where the brokers seem not to operate that way, and a lot of the onus is put on the buyer to find the deal. Yes, I think, you know, there is probably a need for that in the market.
So if you're getting into this, let's say you've got a business you've got your eyes on, you're interested in maybe digging a little bit deeper, potentially examining a purchase. What kind of problems do you kind of have to be ready to deal with? And what kind of problems are things that you're just going to inevitably come across when you're looking at some of these smaller e-commerce stores?
All of them.
do we need to do another episode for this?
Yes, perhaps. Everything. I mean, I'll just run through a few of the things that I have run into. I mean, the most obvious one is bad accounting, and whether this is unintentionally bad accounting or intentionally bad accounting. A lot of these businesses are just small businesses, and Andrew, you and I have had discussions, and we're fairly finance savvy about just what a pain in the ass it is to keep our books. And so folks who are less financially savvy, frequently their books are not very clean. So what you'll have to go in and do is, and what I do is I verify their revenue. So I get their reports from their shopping cart, but that's not good enough for me. What I will, or definitely is not good enough for me what's in their accounting system. I'll get the dumps from their shopping cart, but then I'll also get their merchant account statements, and or their Amazon.com seller central statements, or the statements from whoever is actually processing the payments from their customers. And then I will add those up and try to basically reconstruct their revenue from how much they have actually billed. And then I also I get their bank account statements for the past, for the period. And then I reconcile that, basically the delta in balance. You know, if they have $10,000 more at the end of June, you know, than they did at the end of May, they should probably be showing roughly $10,000 in profit for that month. So I try to use those to inform what the numbers actually are also. So bad numbers is one thing. The other thing is aggressive ad backs. So for those who are not familiar, an ad back would be something that the seller considered that was not related to the business, but maybe they had just run through the business. You know, a good example of this is a lot of small business owners will have the business pay for their car. You know, and if you have an e-commerce business or whatever, the car is not related to the business. They've just got it in the business basically for tax reasons. So what they'll do is they will basically add that back to whatever the profit of the business is to get to their seller's discretionary earnings number. So if they made, I mean, just to make this very simple, if they made $10,000, but they also spent $10,000 on paying for their car payments, they would report SDE as $20,000. Now, that being said, the car is probably a legitimate ad back. I have seen everything under the sun sellers try to claim that, oh, this expense won't transfer for the business with the business, or you won't incur this expense, whereas I did, etc. I mean, I've had people, you know, try to say, "Oh, this business could be totally automated, so I'm going to add back all of my rent expense." And I'm like, "Okay, well, if you want to add that back, then we've got to subtract, you know, what I would have to pay for fulfillment. You know, if you don't want to do it, if you don't want to hold the inventory in your own warehouse." So examine, I mean, this is the number one area where brokers and sellers will try to pull the wool over your eyes as a buyer. Scrutinize the ad backs and dispute them. And they are disputable. You can say, "I do not agree with that as an ad back. I'm reducing the SDE that you've reported by this amount that you've added back, because I think this is an ongoing cost to the business." So funky ad backs are a huge red flag that you should be paying attention to.
And that's a good kind of segue also into how much leeway in negotiation room is there? And obviously it's going to vary on a case-by-case basis. But, you know, you think about real estate and people, it obviously depends on the real estate market, but a lot of times what people list a house for is not what they expect to get. And so when you're looking at these deals, is there an average? And again, this may be tough to say given the variance in different companies and deals and circumstances, but is there an average you can expect to be able to, you know, knock off a price with some solid negotiation in terms of what you can counter offer to ask price for a business?
It's so hard to say on a deal by deal basis, but it is very easy to say that the price they listed for is not the price they expect to sell for ever. So there's always room for negotiation. And so one thing also I have found is that the price you pay is not simply the price you pay. There are also the terms. You know, you might pay 50% down, and then they might give you some seller financing where they might say, "Hey, you can put 50% down and you can pay me the remaining 50% over the next 2 years." Now, a seller might want X, you know, and they might say, "Yeah, pay 50% of X down and 50% over 2 years." But you can say, "How about I just give you 75% of that number cash up front?" And that might be more compelling to the seller.
Never understood why sellers would want to finance their company. And so pretty much if you're selling a company, if you finance it for the buyer, you're turning into a bank for them. And you know, you've got the risk of them defaulting and you having the company again. You've got the risk of them running the business into the ground and then walking away. And then you don't have any collateral left because the business is worthless. So it has always boggled my mind why people are willing to finance the purchase of their business to some random third party. Is it just because they're really desperate to sell?
Yeah, I think that's purely it. I don't think they want to be the bank. I think they just do it. I think I've seen businesses listed for a cash upfront number and then not move for 3 months and then get relisted at the same price but with some seller financing. I think it's just purely the market is just not very liquid in these types of businesses, and I think sellers just are forced to do it in order to get their business to move.
That's interesting. So this is, I mean, one of those markets where cash really talks. If you've got cash and you can pay cash for a business, you can, especially if somebody already has it listed as a seller financed business, you've got some pretty strong negotiating power.
Hell yes. If you have cash in the bank and you can show up and say, I don't need, I mean, because all the time they deal with people, I mean, think of selling a house, right? If a buyer comes to you and goes, oh, I need a mortgage to buy this house from you, you're going to be a little nervous about whether they're going to get that mortgage. But if a buyer shows up just with cash in his hand and says, here's, you know, 10% less or 20% less or 40% less than the price that you listed it for, and I don't need any financing, here's the money, you might go, money in the hand is pretty good. Right?
Yeah, anytime you can remove contingencies for a sale, it's going to expedite, yeah, the
negotiation. Right. Yeah. So if you're in a position as a buyer to come with cash, definitely let the seller know.
What do you think about deal multiples? We've talked about this from an investment, from purely an ROI standpoint. If you go out and try to invest in CDs right now, you're going to get a paltry 0.5% if you're lucky. If you go out and buy a treasury bill, 10-year treasury bill, what, 2% maybe? I'm not sure, around there. And even if you're investing in like kind of risky junk bonds, you know, you're looking at 10% maybe and still taking on a decent amount of risk. And so, but you look at some of these smaller e-commerce deals, and let's say you go out and you're able to get a company that generates $50,000 of income for $100,000 per year. And so effectively that's a 50% plus or minus a 50% interest, you know, return on your money, or a 50% kind of interest rate that you're earning. So what do you think about that? Do you think e-commerce deals are pretty fairly priced right now based on, you know, a lot of the uncertainty and the risk and all the diligence you have to do? Or do you think it's something where there's a decent amount of opportunity, and over the next, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 years, we're going to see those multiples start to rise?
I will preface this by saying that as a capitalist, the market price is the fair price. And it seems like, I mean, I've been watching this market for a while, and the multiples have remained relatively constant. So it seems that the market clearing multiple for these types of businesses is, you know, roughly 2 to 3 times, one to three times, somewhere in there. But to answer your question, yes, I think e-commerce businesses are a fantastic investment. If you know what you're buying and you can get comfortable with the risk, the payback can be fantastic. Now, I'm not trying to put everybody's mom's 401k in e-commerce businesses. But if you know what you are doing, especially if you have an established e-commerce company like you or I, to deploy additional cash into bolt-on acquisitions, I think makes a ton of sense. If you are an expert operator and you know that you're not going to tank this business right away. And I think this kind of, I know you had listed on things we wanted to chat about, you know, kind of buy versus build. So that maybe I'll take a second to comment on buy versus build right now, because these stores, you know, they do seem relatively cheap right now. If you're paying 2 times cash flow, you have your money back in 2 years. And then after the third year, you've made 50%.
Actually, you've made 150%, because if you still got the asset, the business asset that you could sell for,
yes,
conceivably, you know, 2x.
Yes, you could liquidate the asset at any time, theoretically. Yeah. So yeah, the payback is tremendous. But if you've never done this before, I would be very hesitant to plunk down $100,000 to buy a business, because you might not know exactly what you're getting into. It might not be, if you don't have any experience operating a business, you could get into trouble. And the thing is, if you tank it, it might not be recoverable. You know, if all your customers leave you and switch to the competitor, or you lose the trust of your customers for some reason, you're not getting your initial investment back. So if you are confident in what you're doing, it's fantastic. But if you are just starting out, these businesses are not that expensive to start. I mean, I think I started KP Elements with just under $10,000. Was my initial investment. And everything after that was paid for out of the profits of the business. So for $10,000, you can, and then this varies, obviously, you know, if you're trying to get, if you have invented a new kind of go-kart and you need it manufactured in China and cast from steel, that's a different ballgame. But most businesses are not expensive to start. And Andrew, I know for drop shipping, I mean, you started for less than that.
Oh, I think $1,500 was my total capital starting point. Yeah, and everything else was just reinvested profits.
Yeah, so you can get started on your own for much less and not risk being way in over your head by buying an established business. The pro to buy is that you basically get to skip the early part. You're buying time is what you're buying. You get to skip the ramp. But the ramp is the learning opportunity, I think, for a new entrepreneur. So maybe you don't want to skip that all the time.
Yeah, it's a tough call. And I tend to agree with you, because if you build something from scratch, you know intimately how everything works, and if you haven't been in the space before, it gives you a crash course in being able to pick up a lot of skills without having to have a ton of capital on the line. And there's a lot of value in that. if you haven't done it before. $100,000 purchase for your first time e-commerce store is not the way to dive in. In terms of, you know, buying businesses, selling businesses, any topics or last kind of parting thoughts you'd like to mention that we didn't dive into?
You know, as I mentioned, when you're looking for a business to buy, it can be a phenomenal investment, especially if you already have a business. It'd be a great way to grow, especially if you can buy something in the niche that you're already in. And, you know, one thing that I didn't quite get to, things that I look for, is a business that I know how to improve. So I've built a lot of expertise in how to do outsource fulfillment, how to automate, you know, kind of order flows to and from the fulfillment warehouse. I've got a couple of fulfillment partners that I already work with that I'm very comfortable with. So fulfillment is a core expertise of mine. So I look for businesses that maybe are doing their own fulfillment. Maybe they've got like two guys in-house all day picking, packing orders. And I know that I can fire those guys, sell the warehouse, and outsource the fulfillment, and it makes financial sense for me because that is the skill set that I have. Or I look for businesses that have a phenomenal product, but their website is not well designed and it needs some conversion rate optimization or a total redesign, or their brand is not, the aesthetics of their brand is not very good, even though the brand may still have very loyal followers. So those are things I know how to fix. I already have that expertise, and I already know what I would do on day one when I own the business. I know what my to-do list is versus just, I'm going to generally improve this business, or I'm going to buy it and cross my fingers and hope that it improves. So look for businesses where, you know, look at the skill sets that you have, or, you know, it might be, you know, Andrew, in your case, you've already got an audience that knows, wants to buy trolling motors from you. You might, you know, you might be interested in buying a company that sells fishing rods because you know that you could cross market, things like that. You know, look at the skill sets you have and try to buy a business that fits where you have an unfair advantage over other buyers.
Bill, and you're starting a new blog, rebelceo.com. I know you were thinking a while about the name, and I think you got an awesome one. I love that name. So can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to be writing about over there?
Yeah, so at Rebel CEO, I'm going to be basically writing about the idea that you need to challenge all of your assumptions. I mean, in business, Andrew and I, you know, I'm doing almost 7 figures, hopefully, in revenue, and I'm the only employee. And if you go to school in college, they're not going to tell you that that's possible. So Rebel CEO is about e-commerce. It's about building a business. It's about lifestyle design. It's about challenging the assumptions of business building and trying to make it work in a way that is maybe non-conventional.
I'm excited to get that on my RSS feed and start digging everything that you're going to be writing over there. I'm sure it's going to be a ton of really good stuff. So
maybe I'll interview you.
Yeah, I'd love to. Let's do it again. And Bill, thank you so much for coming on. It's been fun. Again, that's rebelceo.com. Make sure to check out Bill's writing. Good stuff. Looking forward to doing it again. And thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Bill. That's going to do it for this week. But if you enjoyed the episode, please make sure to download my comprehensive 55-page guide to building a profitable store at ecommercefuel.com/ebook. This week, a big thank you going out to prize winner David of Simi Valley, California, for downloading the guide recently. David, I'm going to be hooking you up with... Oh, man. Sometimes these prizes embarrass even me. Going to be hooking you up with a toilet bowl coffee mug to give a little more weight to your insult that the office coffee tastes like crap. Pretty bad. Please... don't abandon the podcast yet. Hopefully I won't be this cheesy every week. But David, hope you get some humor out of it. And again, to download that ebook and automatically be entered to win something strange and completely impractical each week, go to ecommercefuel.com/ebook. Thanks so much for listening, and look forward to seeing you again next Friday.